Right? Okay. So let me talk about this. And what's, you may have heard a lot about neutrino flavor transformation, but you know, an old friend, if you know about the Dirac equation, is neutrino anti-neutrino transformation. I'll talk a little bit about that. This is an old friend in a new guise. So we tried to derive the equations of motion. We did derive the equations of motion for the neutrino fields from first principles. And when we arrived at our final equations of motion that govern the neutrino fields, you discover something interesting about neutrino spin that wasn't known before, namely that there is a spin coherence term that shows up that means that neutrinos and left-handed particles, left-handed neutrinos and right-handed antineutrinos in medium effectively have different interaction strengths, different effective masses in medium. So that the propagation states of left-handed and right-handed neutrinos, I should say that the energy eigenstates or propagation states are not coincident with the helicity states. So that's interesting, and I'll show you that it allows for the possibility that maybe you can get transformation between left-handed neutrinos and right-handed antineutrinos if you mine a lot of particles in astrophysical environments. And that's very interesting because many aspects of astrophysics, like nucleus synthesis, for example, and like the energy deposition in supernovae and compact objects, are very dependent on the ratio of nuVs to nuE bars. So anything that messes around with that relative flux of nuVs and nuE bars can be quite important. So stop me at any point. So, and we're not the only ones that have done this either. So when I say we, I mean my graduate student Alexei Vlasenko and Vincenzo Cirilliano at LANL and myself, and we have three papers on this now, but also in parallel, Christina Volpe and her collaborators in Europe and Saro and Volpe have also looked at this and effectively derived the same equations, albeit in a different way. We start from fundamental field theory and essentially do power counting in small quantities. The neutrinos we're interested in are astrophysical neutrinos, which typically have energies of maybe tens of MeVs, with masses, as you know, of order something like 0.1 electron volts. So we can expand in quantities like that ratio. Whereas Volpe et al. Have looked at, they've used a BBGKY kind of hierarchy approach, which is something that's typically used in condensed matter physics, looking at long wavelength, relatively low energy, collected modes between nu and nu bar. Mm-hmm. But in the end, the physics is basically the same. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I just say that, you know, it's sometimes difficult for me to straddle both worlds on neutrino physics and also in the supernova astrophysical side of things. The astrophysics community interested in supernovae and compact object mergers frequently doesn't like to put this physics in because it's extremely difficult to put in. I'll show you why. But I claim that it's not an optional exercise, in my opinion, if you want to understand how these things work. It may be that it doesn't do anything. We don't know. But that's the point. I think you can't tell until you actually do the calculation. So I would just say that we have measured neutrino flavor mixing parameters from a laboratory. And I have some respect for something that's actually measured in the laboratory as opposed to some theoretical idea. Moreover, neutrinos, we do know, carry most of the energy and the entropy in these environments of compact object mergers and core collapse supernovae. And the way the energy is transported and deposited, maybe the way we detect the supernova neutrino burst and the gout from a galactic event, is all flavor dependent. Very, very flavor dependent. So the fact that neutrinos mix their flavors in vacuum, they have rest masses, they have mass squared differences that are measured, they have mixing parameters that are largely measured, I think it's incumbent on us in the astrophysics world to actually calculate what happens. So why is it important? Again, one of the reasons is that these reactions, actually the competition between them, just like in Big Bang nuclear synthesis, really determine the ratio of neutrons to protons. And that's a key parameter for nuclear synthesis, for basically everything that happens. So if you start messing around with the relative fluxes, if you start converting electron neutrinos into electron antineutrinos, for example, what would happen? Well, if they're both very high energy and roughly equal fluxes, then we get kind of equal numbers of neutrons and protons. But if we start converting nu e's to nu e bars in an environment where nu e's were dominating, then look what happens. You would increase the destruction rate of protons and the production rate of neutrons, and you kind of disable the destruction rate of neutrons. So you could drive the material very neutron rich, for example. That's very interesting. So we'd like to know whether that happened. So moreover, the fluxes and the energy spectra of all these six active neutrino species may be different at different places and at different epochs in the supernova environment. And therefore, flavor conversion, either in the conventional flavor oscillation channels, that can affect this competition as well if the nu e's and nu mu's and nu tau's have different energy spectra. But spin flip transitions that interconvert left and right, that change antineutrino into neutrino and vice versa, that can directly influence this as well. Okay. So what we've learned, it turns out that any of these things, either traditional flavor mixing in medium or this, they're very, very difficult to model computationally. But what we do know from what we've modeled so far, at least for number two here, flavor transformation, is that nonlinear feedback does some amazing things. So whereas a linear analysis might suggest to you that from what we measure about the mass squared differences of neutrinos are small. They're very small. And what we know about their energies and what we know about the matter densities in these environments, our linear analysis would tell us, and I authored a number of these papers a decade ago or more, say nothing's going to happen. Well, we couldn't do the nonlinear numerical calculations then. Since then, we've been able to do them, and we find out that we were wrong. As in many cases, your linear physicist thinking analysis is just not right in a very fiercely nonlinear environment. So now when we can do the calculations of number two, we find out that there could be huge collective flavor oscillations, even at very high density and even with very small mass flow. Okay? So number three, we don't know about. And I'll show you the linear thinking says that nothing really should happen here. But we can't figure out how to do the nonlinear calculation. And that we can suggest why there could be a nonlinear feedback mechanism that amplifies this, which would be interesting astrophysically.
George, nonlinear means it includes at least the neutrino background. Is that?
That's what I mean by nonlinear. Yeah, so the words neutrino background mean this. These environments I'm talking about, quark collapse and neutron star mergers, they have huge neutrino fluxes coming out of them. So if your thinking is like neutrino oscillations, the MSW mechanism in the sun, for example, neutrino contributes, forward scattering contributions to the effective mass of neutrinos is negligible because there just aren't very many neutrinos flying through the sun. By contrast, if I took a little cubic centimeter of quark collapse supernova material in about the right place, you'd find almost as many neutrinos there, maybe more neutrinos than you would electrons. And moreover, the neutrino-neutrino scattering is interesting because that scattering amplitude, the way that scattering that process brings in a potential that determines how neutrinos change their flavors depends on the flavors of the neutrinos. That's why it's nonlinear. So we call that neutrino-neutrino forward scattering contribution to those potentials that determine the flavor transformation, we call that the neutrino background problem. Okay. So I can give you the conclusions that we have for flavor transformation. Experimental neutrino physics has given some of the mass and mixing properties of neutrinos, almost all of them we need actually to calculate flavor transformation in the core of the supernova. And neutrino flavor evolution is sensitive to these, But these spin flip processes may be sensitive to other kinds of beyond standard model physics, like the mass hierarchy, like the magnetic moments, if the neutrinos have any, maybe even standard model kind of magnetic moments. Absolute neutrino mass, the Majorana Dirac nature of the neutrinos, and interestingly enough, unlike flavor transformation, the spin transformation is sensitive to Majorana phases. Maybe that's not very surprising. If you think about double neutrinos, double beta decay, it's spin flip that's at the heart of that phenomenon, right? And there's a phenomenon that we think is our probably only bona fide laboratory probe of Majorana phases. Okay. Neutrino subcoupling has led to, that's this neutrino background, has led to lots of surprises, as I said. I will say that the models we have, even of this phenomenon, are fairly crude so far, and here's advertising for where why we might want to detect a supernova neutrino burst from a galactic supernova, because I think we could learn some interesting things, perhaps, even about fundamental neutrino physics, but we certainly learn a lot about quark collapse. So let me say something about core collapse and neutron star mergers, compact object mergers. Why are they a really interesting laboratory for studying fundamental neutrino physics? I'll give this answer, I think in a nutshell, it's just this. Core collapse supernovae are very cold, highly electron lepton number degenerate systems. You think, well, supernovae are hot, you're wrong. They're extremely cold. They have very high electron Fermi energies compared to the temperature. So from the thermodynamic standpoint, they're extremely cold. Their entropies are very low. Because of that, many of the phenomena in core collapse are just exquisitely sensitive to lepton number violation. So that's what's intriguing to me about core collapse. It's not like the early universe where the entropy is very high, and there are roughly equal numbers of neutrinos of all kinds, and neutrinos and antineutrinos. Core collapse is very different. It's on a knife edge that way. Okay, so that's intriguing. And so ultimately what I'm hoping to get sometime is, are macroscopic effects in the supernova or the neutrino signal we would get from a collapse or a neutron star merger, either flavor oscillations, we know that's very sensitive to the neutrino mass hierarchy, probably we'll get the neutrino mass hierarchy from the laboratory in what? What's your best guess? 5 years? Are 3 years? 2? Okay, I'm good with that. So once we know the hierarchy, our simulations become predictive in an interesting way for what we might get in a supernova neutrino burst. And this spin coherence I'll talk to you, it's sensitive to the Majorana Dirac nature of neutrinos and absolute masses and Majorana phases, as I'll show you. So this is just a kind of a rundown on the energetics of core collapse supernovae, the thing the astronomers get all excited about, the optical and kinetic energy in this explosion is about 10 to 51 ergs, but the total energy release, gravitational binding energy release, is 10% of the star's rust mass, that's 100 times that. So these are truly neutrino phenomena. There's the rust mass, and we're basically radiating all of that on a time scale, a diffusion time scale. The neutrinos rattle around and random walk their way out of essentially a neutron star, a proto-neutron star, on a time scale of several seconds, a diffusion time, a random walk time. And they more or less decouple and freely stream through a neutrino transparent envelope on top of that, like photons through a piece of glass. Okay? So this is really the only time scale in the problem. And we have kind of equipartition of energy among all 6 active neutrino species. So I could take that gravitational energy, divide by 6, and divide by the only time scale, the diffusion time scale. The luminosity is a few times 10 to 51 ergs, typically per each of the 6 species. So that's kind of where supernova core collapse is. Neutron star mergers, more or less the same picture. Energetically, more or less the same. Most all the energy is coming out in neutrinos. So the charge to neutrino astrophysicists is that we need the fluxes and energy spectra of each flavor or type of neutrino at all epochs and at all radii, from deep in the core all the way to maybe detection of a supernova neutrino burst of the Earth. And along the way, we might want to understand nucleosynthesis in the supernova, where we'd again want to know what the energy spectrum fluxes are for all these species. So I don't have to tell you guys what we know and what we don't know about neutrino masses. We know the mass square differences. Of course, we don't know the absolute masses or even the mass hierarchy. But we'll measure this in 2 years. That's great. Of course, the takeaway message from the experiments is that the energy states, right, the mass states, so-called mass states of neutrinos are not coincident with the weak interaction ion states, and there's some unitary transformation between them that I can represent like this as a series of rotations. And you know, there are four parameters in that unitary transformation, three angles in the CP violating phase, and we measure the three angles. That's great, and there are people wanting to measure the CP violating phase. We don't really care so much about the CP violating phase in this problem in dense matter, because the matter interactions with neutrinos themselves are grossly CP violating. Right? There's a very different effective mass for a mu e as compared to a mu bar. So the matter, the medium-induced CP violation is huge compared to that inherent vacuum CP violation. So we're not so dependent on that. Now, of course, this is in vacuum, and in medium, it's a very different relationship between the propagation states and the flavor states. And I should say, if neutrinos are Majorana, then we need to add to this unitary transformation the Majorana phases. And so in general, for a 3x3 problem like that, there are two Majorana phases. There they are. So, you know, we hope if we can do neutrinos double beta decay, might get a handle on something like that. Who knows? There's a lot of issues in that problem as well. It's the only way we can think of so far to get at those Majorana phases. Another possibility, as I'll suggest to you, is supernovae. And I don't know how realistic a possibility that is, but I'll show you that this spin transformation can depend on those Majorana phases and on the absolute masses. So that's kind of why I'm interested in this problem. And you know the story, and medium is a different story. Okay, so what am I talking about by effective masses in medium? Well, just think of something really simple. Just neutrino electron forward scattering. Think of photons going through a piece of glass. We always give this example of photon polarization and birefringence of materials as an example, a simple physical analog of what happens with neutrino oscillations. Although I've always been worried about finding some kind of a nonlinear version of that until I talked to Ray Sawyer this morning, who has several papers on the subject. Pretty impressive. So this analogy is not crazy. It actually has other physical ramifications and analogies in photon physics, for example. But just think of the Lagrangian for neutrinos and electrons. There's a part for a neutrino, a part for electrons, and there's some current interaction through like this. Okay? Very simple. All right? And let me just define some kind of a potential then. I'll just rearrange this, and I'll say, here's the electron current, the weak electron current, and I'll define it to be this. And so there's a time-like part to that, and there are three space-like components to that potential. Okay? All right? Then from that, I could write this neutrino Lagrangian this way. Okay? And then I could get the Euler-Lagrange equation for that. And it looks, of course, just like a Dirac equation. There you go. Right? And there's the time-like part of that potential that's generated by the electron current. And there's a space-like part of that potential. And here's the usual kind of, you know, gamma naught times gamma mu, the usual Dirac spinners, Dirac matrices. Okay? And there's our space-like part of the this potential. There's the time-like part. Okay? So there's a dispersion relation I can get from that. And it looks like this. If this is the neutrino energy and this is the three momentum of the neutrino, then you can see how the time-like part of that interaction potential from the neutrino scattering on the electron comes in. And there's the space-like part. Okay? I can expand this like so. Okay, just take square both sides. And so this is what I would get. If I then asked for taking some kind of mean field average of these interactions in medium, then you get something that looks like this, okay? So the usual thing you're probably familiar with from MSW is the mean field average of the time-like piece of potential, okay? This one you don't really care about in the sun because it's a medium average of an inner product, right? Now the neutrino picks out a direction, its momentum has some direction, and I'm now averaging the electron current around it so that that dot product averages to zero for the sun, right? So in the sun, we usually ignore that for MSW. In a supernova, we can't ignore it because now the distribution of neutrinos is not isotropic, it's anisotropic. So if this is the neutron star with this radius, and I'm sitting out here, then these neutrinos are coming from some cone of directions like this. Okay? And so if I'm interested in the flavor evolution of this neutrino, and this has this free momentum, then you can see that the different neutrinos all come in here at different angles, but it's not isotropic. So that this average won't be, the average of this will not be zero. If the distributions are anisotropic. So there's our familiar MSW term for the effective mass or effective interaction neutrino. We ignore these square terms because they go like G Fermi squared, so they're very small. These terms go like G Fermi, okay? So they're much larger. All right, so this one has a cosine theta in it, so in isotropic conditions, that will average to zero. But in anisotropic conditions, it won't. Now, this is very important. So it says, for example, that if I have, it's physically easy to understand this, if you have two collinear neutrinos, this says that the angle between them is zero, okay? But it'll bring in effectively no contribution here because it'll come out that in that limit where the neutrino is ultra-relativistic, think about it, the potentials themselves are null, right? They're a null vector. So the magnitude of the time-like piece is equal to the magnitude of the space-like piece, right? The neutrino has very high energy, so it's on a null worldline. And in that limit, for two collinear neutrinos, that's just one, but these are effectively equal. And there's a minus sign right there, and that just comes from the 1 minus gamma 5 in the current. So that for two collinear neutrinos, they never scatter on each other, right? Moving at the speed of light on the same world line, they never scatter on each other. They don't bring any potential into this, okay? No addition to the vacuum mass theory is brought in by those. And so, think about this. The further away I move, this point where I'm interested in the potentials that govern flavor transformation, the further away I move from the neutron star, the narrower and narrower that cone of neutrinos becomes, the more anisotropic it becomes. So eventually, you move far enough away, the potentials will drop to, you know, negligible values from the neutrino from its gamma. Okay? And in fact, typically what we find is that the density of matter will typically, if you look at the supernova models, drop like, this is radius, drop like 3 powers of the radius, and that means that the potential from neutrino electron scattering will drop like 3 powers of the radius potentials. Okay. But for neutrinos, the potentials will drop like 4 powers of the radius. And the reason for that is you have two factors of dilution. One, just geometric dilution. The further away you are, the lower the flux of neutrinos. And the second, 1 over r squared term, is just coming from the fact that you've got a narrower and narrower cone, and these neutrinos are more and more collinear. Okay? So that's kind of the geometry of what we're dealing with.
Those terms that you're dropping, the G Fermi squared term?
Yeah.
I mean, since you're going to include nonlinear effects, how do you know those won't?
That's a good question. So the nonlinear effects we see are much larger than G Fermi squared. Now, this will not be the case for supernovae. Mm-hmm. Not so sure that's true. You know, where the asymmetry between mu and mu bar might be quite small. Right? In other words, the Lepton numbers are low. Mm-hmm. Okay? That's a good question. All right. So, what's giving us these potentials? Well, I mean, I just gave you an example for neutrino, electron neutrino scattering on electrons, just forming scattering, for example. Okay? And there are neutral current interactions as well, which are flavor blind, which don't care. They can skip a neutrino, any flavor X here, it can scatter on electrons or any kind of quarks in the universe or whatever. Thank you. All right. Okay, let me just skip over that. I don't want to say that. Let me say it in words. So I have this kind of current structure in mind. And the way I wrote that down, remember that there's effectively an interaction, a potential here. We call the potential this, right? And this is what we saw had a time-like piece and through space-like pieces. Okay. And remember that there was a 1 minus gamma 5, this contraction. So it's not terribly surprising that there's a spin term in here, that there's something that can change the spin of the neutrino, right? Because you're going to have something that looks like this. You're going to have an axial vector piece in here, right? From that contraction. There'll be a gamma mu, gamma 5 in there somewhere. The low momentum, low energy transfer limit of that is going to look just like gamma Teller. Right? That's going to have a Pauli spin matrix in it. Okay? So this is going to look something like this, which is gamma Teller. And that changes spin. So that physics is in here somewhere. It's the axial vector part of this. And in fact, I could take this potential from forward scattering and break it up into, you know, a vector part and an axial vector part like that. And it'll be this axial vector part that really has its origin here, this just ordinary gamma Teller, really, that can crank the spin around, right? This is nothing exotic at all. This is a Dirac equation.
George, one piece has to be plus. Yeah.
What's that?
One has to be plus gamma 5 and then gamma, because otherwise it's 0. One's plus.
Okay, so, okay, now, bear with me if this is too stupidly mindless, but I try to explain this to astronomers too, so, and they don't like quantum mechanics, I find out. So, let me remind you what the rules of quantum mechanics are, okay? When you make a, this is like 1928 Copenhagen rules of quantum mechanics. When you make a measurement, you have to get an eigenvalue. Right, that's in the textbook. And the system is collapsed once you make that measurement, get that eigenvalue, the system is collapsed or reduced into the corresponding eigenstate. Right? That's one big rule. Okay? And moreover, there are other rules. There's usually this is given as one rule, that there are ways that the system, quantum mechanical system, evolves in time. There's a Schrodinger-like evolution you get from the Schrodinger equation, which is nice and smooth, and it's a beautiful continuous differential equation. Then there's so-called state reduction or wave function collapse associated with this, maybe associated with a measurement, which is somehow abrupt. Okay. So the quantum kinetic equations effectively combine these two, and you find out that they're not really different. They're the same thing, really, just different limits about how systems evolve. So let me give an example. Let's say I have 2x2 vacuum neutrino oscillations. It's the standard thing you do. Here's probability of finding an electron neutrino or a muon neutrino. Let's say I put in a muon neutrino, I have a beam of muon neutrinos to begin with. Here's some kind of distance traveled by the neutrinos. And there's some small mixing angle that's like the amplitude here. And, you know, after a while, phase builds up, and the probability for finding a mu goes down, the probability for finding a mu e goes up, something like this. Okay? So those are coherent vacuum oscillations, and I know how to get those. At some t equals zero, the state is mu neutrino, and that mu neutrino, that weak interaction eigenstate, is a coherent superposition of energy eigenstates, and I know how energy eigenstates evolve with time. They go like e to the minus I energy times time, so I do that. And now I can find, I can predict what the state of the system is at any later time, and of course it changes the mix of the energy or mass eigenstates. So if I measure here, at this place right here, for example, and now there's not a 100% probability I'll find a new mu. Now there's some probability I'll find some amplitude, and some probability I'll find an electron flavor neutrino. Okay. Now let me describe scattering-induced decoherence. This is another way I can change neutrino flavor. So let me imagine this situation. Now I'll say this in kind of a single particle way, which you might object to because it sounds dumb, but let me do it anyway, okay? So a neutrino is just scattered, and its flavor state has been resolved into the mu flavor state. Now it's propagating towards its next scattering event, which will be one mean-free path away, okay? So as it propagates across that mean-free path, it's effectively propagating coherently. So that means it's building up phase in the oscillation phase, so that now there's a small amplitude for it to be some other flavor state, in this case, electron flavor state. And now, so there's a measurement. And so now as this neutrino comes up after one mean free path on the target is an electron. And so the target asks it a question. What flavor are you? I need to know what flavor you are in order to give you a cross section for scattering. Well, you're asking that question. If you ask the question, you resolve the flavor state. So now, there's a small amplitude, small probability, I should say, that you'll scatter, but you'll scatter into the mu flavor state. Okay. So a scattering event is like a measurement, and it can give something like wave function collapse. Now, this is all said in a ridiculous single particle framework, and in fact, we have to treat the entire neutrino field. This is a many-body process. But nevertheless, that's kind of ultimately sort of what's going on here, okay? So we can start from the fundamental neutrino fields and the matter fields and just derive the equations of motion, okay? Expand those equations of motion in small quantities like mass over energy, G Fermi, various things like that. And we end up with an equation that has this kind of general structure, some kind of kinetic operator that's just a derivative following motion, just a convective derivative or a, you know, covariant derivative along the Lagrangian derivative along the world line of the neutrino. And this is some kind of, this F is, you can think of as the density operator for the neutrinos, i.e. it gives something like this. Each of these is a 3x3 and there's some density, there's some probability to be electron flavor, muon flavor, or tau flavor along the diagonal, right? So this just counts number densities of particles. And then the off-diagonal elements here give the coherence terms, give the quantum mechanical mixing between the different flavor states, okay? So it's a density matrix. And so the structure is always some kind of a derivative along the, like the Boltzmann equation, along the path of the neutrino, the trajectory of the neutrino. This is like a Vlasov operator. And then there's an interaction term. You can just give by some effective Hamiltonian in the medium. And then what turns out is there's a spin coherence term also, and this is what people didn't realize. And that spin coherence term is negligible. This is zero in conditions where the medium, including the neutrino medium, is isotropic. So for example, in the early universe, or in deep in the core of the supernova, where things are isotropic. But out here, where the neutrino field is anisotropic, that will not be zero. Okay? So we can write that down, and I'll show you what that looks like in gory detail later. But there are two limits that are easy to identify. One is the very low density limit, where neutrinos effectively are propagating coherently through, you know, transparently through the envelope. So they're out here, and there's this envelope of matter that the neutrinos are propagating through, and it's like photons in a piece of glass. So the neutrinos are picking up potentials here, but it's just like MSW in the sun. Okay? We could ignore direction-changing scattering and look only at forward scattering that gives an effective mass. And I'll show you later when that's wrong. Okay? It can't be wrong. But for the most part, it's right. And then there's another limit where scattering, direction-changing, sometimes inelastic scattering, dominates. And then we can ignore neutrino phases, quantum mechanical flavor phases, altogether, and you get the Boltzmann equation. Okay? Quantum mechanics doesn't come into that at all. So these two limits. And the way the supernova community, the astrophysics community, has approached this problem is that at low densities, we use this. Okay? And at high densities, down in the core of the supernova, we use this. Okay? So we use the Boltzmann equation down in here, where the neutrinos are rattling around, and use the Schrodinger equation out here. Okay? So we rely on a kind of separation of scales, at least in the astrophysics community. I'll show you a bit later why that's highly suspect. Okay? All right, so this is where neutrino flavor oscillations live, and collective neutrino flavor oscillations live. And I can show you roughly what that looks like. I don't want to talk a lot about that, but I want to show you one thing. I want to show you that nonlinearity can engender these collective nonlinear neutrino oscillations, even though on the face of it, in a linear regime, it looks very unpropitious to get them. So if I, for example, want to know in this coherently propagating regime, this transparent regime, if I want to know the flavor history of that neutrino, I can assume that it just is emitted from the surface of some neutron star, make it spherical. I can uniquely characterize the direction just by giving the angle relative to the normal on the neutron star where it was emitted. And then there's another neutrino that comes along here and forward scatters on it. Okay, so now I have to, you know, the forward scattering will affect the flavor evolution of that guy as well as that guy. And then there's another one here. You can see this gets very complicated very quickly, but it's still just a linear Schrodinger, it's just still a nonlinear Schrodinger equation we're solving. And if you think about it, if I show you this Schrodinger-like picture over here, we have to solve, to do this right, we found out that we have to solve some many millions of coupled nonlinear partial differential equations. These are nonlinear Schrodinger equations. Okay? In fact, about 7 or 8 million in a typical problem that we solve. That's doable. That's actually not even that hard to do.
Where does this number come from, the millions? Because you would expect that if you have like many particles emitted, you have actually more equations or so. I mean,
well, it has to do with just resolution, and mostly we're trying to resolve these angles.
Okay.
So we find that we bin this problem, and we roughly have to have something of order 1,000 angle bins in order to get sufficient resolution and convergence in the calculations, in addition to a lot of radial bins as well. Okay. Now, recently, Shashank Shalgar, who's a postdoc with YU Dwan at the University of New Mexico, Dwan and Shalgar have a really interesting way to do this with moments that could actually reduce the size of these calculations tremendously if that works out. And they demonstrated, for example, that they can get what we get with this. And I'll just say that, you know, big computers allow us to calculate these things. So this, we did this first this calculation 8 years ago, actually. And this was YU Dwan and Yong Chen and Joe Carlson and myself. And we found this. So here's the cosine of that emission angle. So, and here's neutrinos on the top, antineutrinos on the bottom. Neutrinos on the left, antineutrinos on the right. Normal mass hierarchy on top. Inverted mass hierarchy on the bottom, and this is just 2x2 flavor mixing. We can do full 3x3 mixing now. And this is far away from the supernova. And this is energy here in units of millions of electron volts. And the vertical scales are this cosine of this emission angle. So things at the top are moving out radially. Radially at the top, as you come down, more and more tangentially propagated neutrinos. And what you find is what we call the spectral swap or split. That for in the normal mass hierarchy, essentially all the neutrinos below a certain energy are converted, not so much above that. And for the inverted mass hierarchy, it's the other way around. So that's kind of interesting. Large-scale collective oscillations. We see these swaps or splits in lots of things. Here's a calculation by Rafelt and Smirnov and Dasgupta, similar kinds of phenomenon. So we know it's a general phenomenon. Now, what I showed you here is for a spherically symmetric supernova. We know that supernovae are not spherically symmetric, real supernovae. So this is kind of the spherical Powell approximation. What else are we going to do? Well, turns out we may have to do other things. So this is what a real supernova might look like. This is a calculation by, I believe, the Mesa Kaplan Blunden group that just shows a map of entropy, and you can see that there are, these convective plumes of downward flowing really low entropy stuff and outward flowing really high entropy hot stuff, different compositions. It's a mess. And in fact, this is the thing that the astrophysicists, they think that these inhomogeneities and these convective motions are actually really important in getting the supernova to explode. We in the neutrino physics business don't really care whether the supernova explodes or not. It's just the collapse itself is a wonderful source of neutrinos as far as we're concerned. There's not much energy in that explosion anyway, as I showed you. Okay, so there's been a lot of progress towards these consistent quantum kinetic understanding of how neutrino flavor evolves in the supernova environment. And this is just a few of the papers involved in it. So let me show you first the effect of a small amount of direction-changing scattering on that otherwise coherent Schrodinger picture I showed you. Very surprising. And then I'll talk a little bit about the spin coherence business and what the linear analysis of that shows you. You should get nothing. And then a suggestion of how you could get nonlinear feedback that would change that conclusion. Okay? So again, here's my picture of this cone. So again, the further away you move, the more and more these neutrinos in this neutrino background are collinear. And so the smaller that potential, right? And so it's going down like 4 powers of radius. And you're getting 2 of those just from geometric dilution, just 1/distance squared. And you're getting another 2 from 1 - cosine of this angle. Okay? So that's going like 1 radius squared also. Okay? So suppose I have a neutrino that does this. Goes out here, scatters, it comes back. Now, in this so-called transparent medium above the neutron star, it turns out that maybe only 1 in 1,000 neutrinos will scatter like that. Because the matter density is relatively low, at least on weak interaction scales. Okay? But notice that this neutrino can come in at some weird oblique angle. There's no reason it couldn't come out here and scatter directly back. Again, there won't be very many of those. But if they do, then this current suppression term is gone. Okay? First person to recognize this was my graduate student, Alexei Vlasenko. The rest of us have been working on this field for a long time and missed this effect.
George?
Yeah.
It's probably just the words, but something worries me about this, that the stuff that you have all going all in your black there, I mean, that was all coherent in the sense that you let it all happen before you square the wave function.
Right.
And so you pick up from here, there, and the other. The other guy for a real scattering, well, that can happen anywhere.
That's right.
Happens one little thing over, it comes in with a different phase.
That's right.
And so you assume all those things just cancel themselves out.
Right. They could cancel out, although this is where the non-homogeneous, non-isotropic, non-spherical nature of the real matter distribution may make a difference. Because you may get a column, for example, of heavy material, right? That its effect is especially effective at scattering, and the length scale of that column may be relatively small.
But the distance there is different for every guy.
But what I'm telling you is that this is a cartoon. The length scales you may be comparing may be, the phase differences are relatively small compared to the change in phase from the neutron star surface.
All I was trying to say was that where there was a change in angle, then that's going to be incoherent.
Yes. Depending on where, the way I've drawn it there, you're probably right. But if, of course, there's some, column of material here with a relatively small length scale, and I'm interested in this place right here, I can get a coherent source of neutrinos.
Yeah, okay.
Right, something like that. But your point is well taken, okay? And we, in fact, haven't been able to do full-up calculations of this in the supernova models. But you can kind of think of places where you might be safe with respect to this, right? Where just the magnitude of the potential, forget about phases, the magnitude might be relatively small. You could say right away that even without phase cancellation, the magnitude of this effect will be, say, 1% of the forward scattering potential or less. Okay? So we call that a safety criteria. There are various matter distributions for different epochs of the supernova, different kinds of supernovae. And as long as this curve, the matter curve, lies below its corresponding safety criterion curve, the dash curve, you're okay and you can ignore any direction-changing scattering. But you can see that there are whole epochs, including the shock reheating explosion epoch, where that's just not true. And so if I look at just the magnitude of this effect, here's the, without what Ray just mentioned, without doing a strict quantum mechanical calculation that takes into account all the interference of the phase. Here's that density plot I showed you earlier. This is, again, from a calculation of Blund and Mesa Kappa, I think. And here's 10 to the 5 in dark blue, 10 to the 10 in red. And you can see these columns of high density colder material that are heavy nuclei and outflowing plumes of hotter stuff. It's very interesting. And if I map that into neutrino scattering now, and ask for the percent correction in the magnitude of the potential that governs flavor transformation at this point, at any particular point out here, you can see that it's actually a leading order effect. It's not perturbative at all. That's right, 1,000%. And so we call this the halo because, of course, it's the scattering further out that would have the dominant effect. So the red here is the percent correction to the coherent potential. And you can see that it's very large further out. Moreover, you can see that the correction to the potential depends on the distribution of matter in an interesting way. It now mirrors the anisotropy in the matter field. Okay? It also depends on composition in a new way. So since it's a bigger effect further out, my graduate student who did this work, John Cherry, named it the neutrino halo. And if you publish a physical review letter, you're always asked to write like a little press release. And I always do that, and none of them ever get picked up. But John Cherry actually wrote a little blurb, and he said that the title of this was that dying stars get a halo. And that got picked up everywhere. And so. All right. Okay.
Jordan?
Yeah.
A political question. I'm sorry to interrupt the talk, but doesn't that policy just encourage hype?
Absolutely. That's why I'm giving it to you. I can't stand it, but what can you do?
Okay.
All right. And please do interrupt me. Anyway, so this is an example. So that, if you think about it, now if I want to calculate flavor transformation out here, in principle now, I've got to consider neutrinos coming in from above and bringing quantum mechanical flavor information down. So whereas before, what I showed you was an initial value problem, which are fairly easy to do. an initial nonlinear Schrodinger equation, initial value problem for a nonlinear Schrodinger equation, a set of them, and you just integrate outwards. Can't do that anymore. So this halo effect converts that initial value problem into something more like a boundary value problem, and it brings in nuclear composition, material composition, in a completely new way. We don't really know how to handle this at all. Okay. All right, so things will get worse. And we can actually calculate what happens in the case of an oxygen neon magnesium core collapse event, because those stars are very centrally condensed, and they have very tenuous outer envelopes here. So the matter density falls off very quickly. And if you sit out here, most of the scattering is coming from below. And we can actually do the calculation and follow the phases correctly, but only for that case so far, because all of our codes that exist are initial value problems. And so, for example, we could map that out, and we see that there's some difference because of the halo in the signal you might expect in a liquid argon detector from a galactic core collapse event. Okay, now full-blown QKEs. So this halo stuff tells you that you should be very careful, that direction-changing scattering can have funny effects that you don't expect, and nonlinearity can amplify them in interesting ways. So again, the quantum kinetic equations look something like this, and here's a 6x6 formulation of them. So this is something like a generalized density matrix. I'll get to that in a second. So here's our differential, here's our operator, our Vlasov-like operator that just gives, you know, D density operators, D some parameter along the world line of the neutrinos, okay? And then there's an interaction term, which is the coherent term. Okay, this gives our Schrodinger-like behavior. And then there's a collision term that gives that flavor transformation from collisions. Okay? So this generalized density matrix is a 6x6 entity that would look like this. Here's our usual 3x3 flavor density matrix, right, for nu e's and nu mu's and nu tau's. And here is the same thing for the antineutrinos. And what's new in the quantum kinetic equations are these spin coupling terms, these spin coherence terms, which are block 3x3 off diagonal pieces that couple the evolution of the nu's and the nu bars. Okay? So here's what one of these Fs looks like. And there's a flavor density matrix for each location, for each event in space-time, and for each momentum. Okay?
Everything here is a matrix of flavor as well as being explicitly a two-spin component.
Correct.
Okay.
Right? For flavor and spin. Okay? So what's new is this new dynamical quantity that encodes spin or helicity of the neutrinos. And the collision terms likewise are 6x6. Again, the usual kinds of things that look very much like the Boltzmann collision terms that the supernova guys use in their neutrino transport along the diagonals. And then the off-diagonal pieces are these neutrino spin flip terms, okay? Now these neutrino spin flip terms I'll come back to in a second, but just suffice it to say that if I write it down, here's the Hamiltonian here, looks like the usual kind of thing for neutrinos, the usual kind of thing for antineutrinos, but now has this block 3x3, I should say 6x6, 3x3, coupling between neutrinos and their velocity flip partners. Okay? And so those terms look something like this. So these are the matter terms, these are the matter potentials. Again, the axial part of this, but again, the parts that are, if I think about the trajectory of the neutrino, the world line of the neutrino, they're the potentials that are transverse. Right? They're space-like potentials transverse to the direction and propagation of the neutrino. You think about what that does, that's going to give precession of the neutrino spin. So that's what's going on here. And so here's mass over energy. That's always got to be there, right? That's just from the Dirac equation. And that is, sure enough, there's no difference here. I talked to Ray this morning. He just wrote this down instantly. So there's nothing new there, okay? And then this is this perpendicular potential. Okay, so if I think of this density operator, and I take the Boltzmann limit, which would be the limit where neutrino and neutrino medium scattering is very large, so the neutrino mean free path is very short compared to any kind of oscillation length, okay? Then what happens is these collision terms mix different energies and flavor states. It's the usual kind of thing with loss of, you know, coherence, decoherence, quantum mechanical decoherence. I think these are quantum computing guys have exactly the same problems. But luckily they're not using neutrinos as qubits. No,
that's not a good general argument there, because of the known fact that in a rather isomorphic problem in magnetic resonance theory, that the scattering part can leave the oscillation part intact.
Absolutely. You're right. And this is the part, it's actually, Ray, it's much easier to get the collisionless Schrodinger equation limit than it is to get this Boltzmann limit. So we can get the Boltzmann limit, but there are things you have to neglect here. So I'll get the Boltzmann limit, there's obviously no coherence, and the mass terms are small enough to discard, but you've got to be very careful because of nonlinearity. So I think that's what you're seeing in the example you gave.
When we say something is called motional narrowing in magnetic resonance theory. Now you figure out why it's called.
I'll let you figure that.
Trace back enough time, you'll find it was invented by Mr. Anderson.
Okay. Fair enough. And that, so it's a little tricky to get this limit, but I have to make these approximations, which I think are reasonable for supernovae, right? Because the mass terms are small. But again, we're keeping some, so this is a little bit tricky. But you end up with something that looks like the Boltzmann equation. It's some familiar, you know, derivative along the direction, and then gain and loss terms that have the right flavor to them, sense to them, I should say. Then there's the coherent limit, where I neglect the potentials relative to the absolute masses. So I drop all, you know, this is like your question, I drop all things that go like G Fermi squared. Maybe I drop products of mass and these potentials. And then in that limit, this spin coherence decouples, doesn't come into the problem at all, and I'm left with the Schrodinger equation. Okay? Then if I just grapple with what these actual spin coupling terms look like, here's the full-blown thing again. So look at this H nu bar, that couples the spins. Again, it has this kind of structure. It looks like this. It's going to go like always, mass over energy, okay? Some kind of weak potential, this one, okay? But again, only the transverse parts of that. That's why we need anisotropy. Otherwise, this will average to zero, okay? And then in addition, you know, so this is already small, right? If I think about what masses are, if I take the mass, to be what? You know, 0.1 electron volts. Typical energies that we're dealing with here are like 10 to the 8. So this number is 10 to the minus 8. And this number, well, this is going to go like G Fermi number density of something. Let's just say baryons. And then I'm only taking the transverse part. I'm only taking the part that depends on anisotropy in the potential, in the neutrino fields or in the matter fields. So one thing that can do this is just a, for example, is just a current of electrons, a matter current of some kind, like those ones I showed you in the picture that Blondin and Mesa Kappa calculated. So just for jollies here, let's say that this is a potential generated, an anisotropic potential generated by an actual current motion of material in the supernova. Then this is like V over C. So what's a reasonable velocity for some of the material in the supernova? Let's just gild the lily and say 1,000 kilometers per second. Okay? So this is already like 10 to the minus 2, and that's an awfully big velocity. I'm sure if there were, you know, I'm sure that if John Blondin were here, or Tony Mesa Kappa, or Adam Burrows, they would probably scream that that was too big. So, okay, if I think about that, then this times this is already down by 10 orders of magnitude relative to the normal term that gives the MSW potential, down by 10 orders of magnitude. Okay? So why don't I stop the talk right here? Okay. So to get this at all, let's review this. Particles have to have a non-zero mass. And notice that this potential, unlike the MSW potential, unlike what comes in with MSW, it's not sensitive to mass squared. It's sensitive to the mass of the neutrino, the absolute mass. You need some anisotropic matter or neutrino potential. Some anisotropic distribution of motion of matter or some anisotropy in the neutrino fields themselves. And that those have to have components that are perpendicular to the momentum direction of the neutrinos. And number three, we have to have the spin coherence present. Okay, well, this is just the difference between right and left-handed neutrinos. This is no big deal. Everybody knows this. Neutrinos are left-handed. Antineutrinos are right-handed. Now, I'm specifically talking about Majorana neutrinos. We can do the same analysis for Dirac neutrinos, but then if I flip helicity, of course, I'm changing a left-handed neutrino into a right-handed thing. And that right-handed thing has to be interpreted as a sterile state, right, if we're talking about Dirac neutrinos. So I'm not going to talk about that. Okay, but think about this. Here's a simple example. Consider one neutrino, one kind of neutrino, one flavor. There's a one flavor limit to give you kind of a feel for what this looks like. Okay? Am I all right on time? Okay. So what am I telling you? So as the neutrino propagates through this anisotropic medium, right? The energy eigenstates, that is the propagation eigenstates, have to be coherent superpositions of right and left-handed states by NOR collisions. Let's just ignore collisions for fun. Okay? So ignore the right-hand side of this quantum kinetic equation. Okay? So these interactions are telling you that left-handed things have a different effective energy and medium than right-handed things. So as the neutrino propagates along, it's a coherent superposition of these right and left-handed states. The energy states are superpositions of right and left-handed states.
I am confused about when you say right and left-handed, of course you can be, you must be considering chiralities, right?
Yeah.
But you may or may not elicitly flip too.
Yeah, these are massive states.
Huh?
These are massive states.
These are massive states, so there is a difference between
yeah,
both.
A difference.
So you can conserve and you can flip
that's right.
Elicity and
that's right.
Change for
yeah. In this ridiculously simple example I'm going to give, I'm not going to distinguish between these. Okay? I'm just going to say a left-handed thing is a neutrino, it's right-handed as any other neutrino.
Okay.
All right. So consider this example, single neutrino type propagating through a supernova envelope. So take our single neutrino to have electron flavor. We then have a 2x2 problem that mixes nu e and nu e bar, left and right, okay? And so in this particular basis, this is what that spin coherence Hamiltonian looked like that I just showed you. But now it's simple, now it's just 2x2. Now it's not 6x6. So here's an ordinary, here's the energy of the electron neutrino. Here's the energy of the anti-electron neutrino. And here's that coupling term between them, okay? So that should be a nu on that one. So I could just call the energy of the neutrino along the diagonal x. And of course, it's minus x for the anti-neutrino, right? Because there are different sign amplitudes for a neutrino scattering on something and an anti-neutrino scattering on something. So that's why there's a minus sign there. And then the off-diagonal pieces that couple the spins, I'll just call C. Okay? Now, the diagonal potentials have a contribution from neutrino forward scattering on electrons, as I showed you. I'll call that the matter term, A. And there's also a contribution from scattering on other neutrinos, which I'll call B, the neutrino background. Okay? So So the matter potential looks like this if you work it out. So anybody ever work on sterile neutrinos here? And MSW with sterile neutrinos? There are some people actually willing to admit that. Welcome to the club, okay? And it's, you know, it's kind of a rogues gallery somewhere that has our pictures in it, I'm sure. But you'll recognize this potential. Okay? Notice that it goes like YE minus 1/3. What is YE? YE is the number density of electrons divided by the number density of baryons. So more strictly speaking, it's this. Number density of electrons minus number density of positrons divided by number density of baryons. Okay? So we had equal numbers of electrons and positrons, YE would be 0. If we had pure hydrogen, YE would be 1. Okay? In a supernova environment, this number can be anywhere between some small number, like say 0.1 or even lower, all the way to something near 0.4 or 0.5. Okay? So in particular, note that this potential could change sign if we move from a region where YE is less than 1/3 to a region where it's greater than 1/3. Okay? And the neutrino-neutrino forward scattering potential looks like this for electron neutrinos, where again, these neutrino number density differences are averaged over this 1 minus cosine theta because the neutrino field here is anisotropic, okay, in this cone. All right. And the off-diagonal potential is just what I showed you before, m over neutrino mass over energy, and then some kind of a term for a potential that's an axial vector potential orthogonal to the neutrino direction. So for example, a matter current term gives something like that, like I wrote down here, okay? So then what I could say is that treat this all coherently, ignore collisions, and then I can write down the neutrino state as some amplitude to be electron neutrino, some amplitude to be anti-electron neutrino, and then that will evolve according to time by a Schrodinger-like equation, so I'm ignoring collisions. Okay, just like that, there's our Hamiltonian. It's the familiar kind of neutrino mixing. This is just like MSW in the sun. Okay? So there's that equation again. And we solve it just the way we can solve that equation for the sun. I can say that the electron flavor is some superposition of the energy eigenstates. Here's the bigger energy eigenstate, there's the lower energy eigenstate, and same for the antineutrino. And then some effective instantaneous in-matter mixing between them with some kind of effective, you know, unitary transformation looks like that between the energy states and the flavor states. And I can transform that Schrodinger-like equation into one that looks like this, which is exactly like the one in the sun. And I can get something like this. So it's the rate of change of these energy eigenstates. And you can see that if there's no coupling at all, if it's completely adiabatic, then these off-diagonal terms will be zero. And that's what we call the adiabatic condition. And here I define these quantities, which look, again, very similar to what one does in MSW in the sun. And so the way to look at it is this. The interesting thing, if I go back and look at this, these potentials can go to zero. For example, near YE of 1/3. Doesn't necessarily have to be exactly 1/3 because there are those neutrino potentials also. So it might be a little bit bigger than 1/3 if the neutrino potential is negative, or a little less than 1/3 if the neutrino potential is positive. So that's interesting, and sure enough, there's a resonance there. And notice that even though these off-diagonal potentials are very small, 10 orders of magnitude down from the usual weak potentials, nevertheless, there's a resonance point where these diagonal guys vanish. And so everything is in control of the off-diagonal potentials, albeit even with their very small values. Okay. So whether or not we, you know, this problem looks adiabatic depends on the rate of change of these effective mixings. That's the rate of change of potential. And so we can figure out when that occurs. I'll just show you in a second. So I can just draw you a picture here's the total potential. So again, there's the energy of the neutrinos. Here's the square of that off-diagonal potential, which is very small. Okay. And here's electron fraction, assuming that the matter density is relatively high. Okay. Remember that. So down here for electron fraction less than a third, the heavier neutrino state will correspond to the anti-electron neutrino. Right? Because there the total energy of the neutrino is large and negative because the electron fraction is less than a third. Okay? And so if I look at that here, that corresponds to an angle, or to these things, of pi over 2. So that says that the electron neutrino is mostly the lighter energy eigenstate, lower energy eigenstate, and the antineutrino is the bigger one. Okay. So sure enough, high density, but y e less than a third, and it looks like this. And here I plotted the energy eigenvalues. And likewise, at higher ye and a lower density, it would be the other way around. And this track, the heavier guy would correspond to the electron neutrino, and the lighter one, the electron antineutrino. So if you're familiar with MSW, the idea is that if the actual track of the neutrino stays this way, if I create, for example, an electron neutrino in the neutronization burst of a core collapse supernova, and no electron antineutrinos, then what happens? If I stay on this track, then far enough out, and that thing is completely converted, its spin is rotated, and it becomes a newly born. Okay? Now, that conclusion is predicated on the assumption that the amplitude doesn't jump. Right? So if you're familiar with MSW and the sun, you know that. So that just says that this off-diagonal term here has to be small compared to the diagonal term. Okay? So let's look at that.
You're also assuming that YE changes continuously from the along the path.
Oh, it does. We'll get to that in a second. You're right. Okay? So, what is this gap? Well, it's the order of magnitude of the off-diagonal potential, which is 10 orders of magnitude down from the ordinary weak potential. So it's ridiculously small. So it's ridiculously easy for the neutrino amplitude to jump from one track to another. Okay? So the linear analysis I just gave you says this ain't happening in a core collapse supernova. It's just not adiabatic, grossly not adiabatic. Okay? Now, one might, okay, I threatened to end the talk earlier. I could end the talk here, except for one thing. Okay? Not adiabatic in this linear approximation, but remember, this is a fiercely nonlinear problem. Fiercely nonlinear. If I start changing nu e's or nu e bars to nu e's, then that changes what happens here. I say start reducing this one and increasing this one. That drives that potential negative potential. Okay. So it has a feedback on the potentials. And you have to look at that feedback. So where we are with this right now is that my graduate student Alexei Vlasenko actually found an interesting nonlinear solution to this, or at least a mechanism that could cause nonlinear amplification of this spin flip process. And it's just this. You know, as you just said, YE can't change abruptly. Moreover, if you think of that resonance, it's roughly where YE is a third. Okay? Somewhere right around there. Won't be exactly that because of the neutrino potentials. So what you want, if you just look at the scale height, the way YE changes in these models, you're not even close to being adiabatic. But if you have feedback, you can keep YE close to a third. So that as the neutrino moves out, YE might be increasing, but the feedback from changing nu e's to nu e bars, for example, lowers the potential and keeps it right at zero. Okay? Okay? So effectively making it adiabatic. Okay? It's not that easy, but it's what he's shown is that it's possible you could do something like that. So remember, we get the resonance with a matter Hamiltonian and this neutrino Hamiltonian vanish. And so what happens is here's that Hamiltonian. Here's some measure of distance along the world line of the neutrino. Here's the initial resonance point, maybe where y is close to a third. And then there are oscillations that come from the spin coherence field itself, the kind of track, and that he showed could find this potential. And the feedback then from the conversion keeps it near there. Okay? And it makes it effectively adiabatic. Okay? Now it's still not that easy. So remember that this effect depends not only on that scale height you just mentioned, but also on the mass. Okay? So if I ask what mass, so here's an interesting calculation. Start off with this spectrum of electron neutrinos only, designed to look like the neutronization burst in a particle-like supernova. We can talk later about what that means. But it's an epoch in the supernova in which most of the neutrinos coming out by a factor of order 10 are electron flavor over other flavors. Okay. So, and the luminosities are extremely high. So this coupling effect is as big as it's going to get. And in that limit, so here's, we start off with this red curve, and then we let his, Alexei Vlasenko's tracking solution kick in, and then far enough out, the blue one are the antineutrinos, so those have been converted to antineutrinos, and the dashed curve here are what's left of the original electron neutrino signal. Okay? But to get that particular numerical calculation, Alexei had to take a mass of one electron mole, which is not visible, okay? Unless, of course, the absolute masses are degenerate in some way, and I don't think they are, but, you know, that's what you'd have to do. Had to take a scale height for the initial potential before you modify it to be of order 10,000 kilometers. Okay? Whereas the physical scale height, if you look in the models, is more like 1,000. So on the face of it, this is going to be pretty tough to do. Although, keep in mind, this is for one kind of neutrino. And now if I put in other kinds of neutrinos, this problem becomes very rich, and the nonlinear couplings become very, very complicated very quickly. Okay? So this is intriguing, but, you know, this is a little bit worse. Okay. Interestingly enough, you could just say nothing I've said here depends on an inherent vacuum magnetic moment for the neutrinos. There's no reason that neutrinos wouldn't have a magnetic moment. In the standard model, they're very small, like 10 to the minus 22 Bohr magnetons. Is that, here's the expert. Is that right? Yes, you are. Something like that. They're ridiculously small. Bohr's name. Something
ridiculous.
Okay, ridiculously small. At least 10 orders of magnitude below what we think supernovae are sensitive to. I know that from the paper that I wrote with you. Okay. So, okay. Andre de Gouveia and Shashank Shalgar actually put in a standard model. Actually, it's like 2 orders of magnitude larger than a standard model, like 10 to the minus 18 or 10 to the minus 19. Or magnetons, coupling, magnetic moment coupling, and they found huge effects of mixing of mu and nu bar because of the nonlinearities involved. We actually, I have to tell you, we think that calculation is not right, but nevertheless, it's suggested that there could be some interesting nonlinear amplification going on. I won't say any more about that. Here, of course, we're not, it's effectively an effective magnetic moment induced by the weak interaction itself. There's not an inherent magnetic moment. So the weak interaction induced magnetic moment is much larger than this, actually, by many orders of magnitude over the one that they take. Okay? I could quit here, or I could show you, I showed you the mass, the absolute mass comes into this. Let me show you how the Majorana phases come in. Okay? So I think I can give you a flavor, no pun intended, for what the nonlinear problem would look like with more flavors, okay?
I have a question. You mentioned with fluorescence the early universe. The early universe, you don't expect any of these effects.
That's correct. But the coherence term, the Vlasov term, is still there. And now in the early universe, the collision term is very interesting.
Yes.
And it has not ever been done correctly. Okay. So let me come back to that at the end.
So before you proceed, I just want to get some intuition about what's going on. So the magnetic moment is basically the mass term. What's the magnetic field here? The analogous?
It's kind of a weak magnetic field,
potential.
A weak interaction, a weak potential.
Sigma.
Yeah. So if I think about an electromagnetic field, it's kind of analogous, right?
Yeah,
it's just,
exactly
right.
The same.
Yeah, this is the same, except it's a weak interaction. So that's in it, okay? So it's small.
So this example that you show, when you are putting as the source of this sigma.
I'm sorry.
For this example that you show, that you say you need like the 10 times the.
Yeah.
You are putting like, for the sigma, you're putting as a source neutrinos and electrons, or where are you putting as a source?
No, neutrinos and electrons and neutrinos and neutrinos.
So you're putting as the source of the sigma,
yes,
also neutrino field.
Yeah, absolutely.
Plus the electron.
In the example I just gave you, in the example in Lexi's paper,
yes,
it's not the electrons.
Yes.
It's assumed to be spherically symmetric with no matter currents.
Right. Okay.
So it's only the anisotropy and the neutrino field that generates the numbers I showed you.
Okay.
Okay?
That makes the thing more complicated when you do more papers.
That's right. That's right. I'll show you what it looks like. So we can do 2x2. So now, if it's 2x2, then here's the density matrix, right, between electron flavor and some other flavor, mu flavor, tau flavor, let's say. And then here's the analogous matrix elements for the spin coherence. And now this overall grand density operator looks like this. Okay, so it'll be 4x4, because now I have neutrino, electron neutrinos, say mu neutrino, tau neutrinos, I have electron neutrinos, electron antineutrinos, tau neutrinos, anti-tau neutrinos, right? And I've got the spin coherence for all of those here. Okay? So here's our quantum kinetic equation. Again, leaving out collision. This is coherent. Okay? And so for that Hamiltonian, I'll take there to be a vacuum part, apart from the matter, meaning neutrino electron forward scattering, and just neutrino and plus neutrino neutral current scatterings on everything, on neutrino and neutrino forward scattering, and then the spin flip part. Okay? So here's the vacuum part, looks just like the usual vacuum neutrino mixing thing. Here's the matter part. Again, that looks just like what we discussed before. You'll notice another way that these things can vanish, Ye close to 1, for example. And then there's a contribution from the just the matter alone. So if this is just matter, the only spin flip part will come from some net current in some way. And if it's spherically symmetric, which I'll take here, the only way you can have a current is radially outward or radially inward. Okay, and then there's some neutrino Hamiltonian. This is the usual complicated thing we don't care about. And it's complicated. We get, that's where all the numerical magic comes in. And this is the neutrino background. Forget about that. And then here's the spin coherence part, which again is proportional to mass over energy. Okay. Now the interesting thing about the spin coherence piece is it looks like this. Here are the block 2x2 terms that mix neutrinos and antineutrinos. Okay. Now with 2x2, you could get an electron neutrino changing into an anti-mu neutrino, anti-tau neutrino. Okay. So again, there's a spin flip part engendered by currents, anisotropic currents in the matter term. Right. That's like this V over C term here. And then there's just the inherent anisotropy in the neutrino fields themselves, which is the big part. Okay. Now, what is the mass that comes in here? Well, here's the mass that comes in, right? I start with some primitive Dirac neutrino. I get this from Boris. I always learn from your slides, Boris. And now these are going to be Majorana neutrinos. So in 2x2, there's one Majorana phase. Okay. So I'll put this in terms of these parameters, mass squared difference, which we can observe or measure, right? And then some kind of average mass, rest mass like this. So I could write the masses, the absolute masses, this way. And then if I do that and do this transformation to the flavor basis, to this particular basis, then what I'll see is something like this. And you can see that those Majorana phases come in a very interesting way. In particular, if I have a situation where the masses are degenerate, right? So that masses in general are larger than the mass squared difference, square root of that, then these Majorana phases come in a very interesting way. They don't cancel out. They're kind of wide in there, right? Whereas, if the masses are very non-degenerate and the mass squared difference, square root of that, is much larger than, right? Okay, so in that limit, this term would dominate. And you can see there that the Majorana phases don't come in an interesting way at all. There's a plus sign there, right? So that ends a minus sign here. So that's interesting. And it's not surprising that this is sort of analogous to the way those mass terms come in double beta decay. It's not exactly the same, but it's pretty close, right? Because again, in double beta decay, you're just flipping spin. So it's not surprising that it has roughly the same kind of structure. So what is surprising to me is that, you know, now with the nonlinearity in this problem, the question is, could you engender through the interactions, you know, large-scale collective oscillations between nu and nu bar somewhere in this environment that depend on this? That's what I find intriguing about this, and I can't, you know. Now you can ask me, how do we model this? And I don't know. I just don't know. It's very complicated. It's quite unlike the kind of modeling we've done for collective flavor oscillations in supernovae. I think we can model the one flavor case, which I showed you. We're trying to model that one now, although that physically you have to wonder, it's kind of a toy problem. How close is it to something that would really happen in nature? I kind of see it as a proof of principle. You know, if we can see some, you know, nonlinear feedback that amplifies things, great. How that translates into three flavors of, you know, neutrinos and antineutrinos, I don't know. Don't know how to work that problem out yet. This is a very complicated problem. There was an exercise in, you know, asking people to think about what they could do computationally at the exascale. And I think we were not very popular at that meeting because this problem is way beyond the exascale, at least on the face of it, way, way beyond the exascale.
Before the question period, the last one that I think is really pressing on me.
Yes.
Just to dream for a moment, if you did the same thing with Dirac neutrinos, I realize the equations are not quite the same. Although all the things involving just affect the coupling.
It's pretty close.
Pretty close. Then your conclusion would be, instead of a minor modification on what's there, which is at most exchanging one spectrum for another, so you're trading on the energy differences, how much more effective electron neutrinos are doing stuff than U and tau to get physical effect. But this would be turning guys wholesale into sterile neutrinos, and it sounds like that would have much more effect. And in your dreams might lead to saying, oh, this rules out Dirac neutrinos. Wouldn't that be nice?
Yes.
All right.
Yes. Okay, but when you, this is a, so the answer to your question is partly sociological, right? So people believe this, because it involves active neutrinos only. As soon as you use the S word, sterile neutrinos, you lose a lot of credibility.
Oh, I just meant the other.
Sorry, that's also an S word.
That's
so your point is very well taken. And I should say that supernovae are very, very, as I said, outside of this, right? The interesting thing about stellar collapse is that it's exquisitely sensitive to these kinds of processes. So changing something into a sterile is dramatic, absolutely dramatic. So my answer to your question this morning was this.
We would call it ineffectual. Is there a way around?
I would say this, right? We don't know how, I mean, Boris is the expert, how do you build sterile neutrinos? We don't know what the sterile neutrino mass scales are. I can pick out interesting mass scales that people pick out for cosmology, for example, like dark matter, and they're not deep.
If you just spin a Dirac neutrino around, can't we call that sterile without arguing about LSND?
Yeah, sure, sure, sure.
There's no mass scale.
Yeah,
am I allowed to do that, Boris, without calling it sterile?
It seems to me it's not entirely sterile anyway, because you can bend the spin back.
Yes, but it will down to the mass of the
if you're in the magnetic field, it's not sterile.
No, of course. We'll call it ineffectual.
So I can tell you what can happen. You know, you want me to negate all this, right, by having things changing steriles and supers. Keep in mind that what I showed you was that the energy in the explosion, the thing that the astronomers did something about, is 1% of the energy in the neutrino field. So for all I know, right, I'm just arguing from, all I know, I can throw away 99% of the neutrino energy, dump it in the sterile neutrinos, and it wouldn't change. How do I know that? I don't know. Moreover, it gets worse. If I have the core, remember we have the shock out here, and we want the neutrinos to come out and heat the material behind the shock, or heat the material down here and transport that energy out by convection fields. Okay? So, in fact, the supernova explosion models are quite sensitive to the luminosity from the neutrino sphere. How do I know I don't have an electron neutrino rattling around in here? There's some resonance point, and it zips out at nearly the speed of light as a sterile neutrino, and then another resonance here that converts it back into an electron neutrino.
Yeah, but this is all because I used the wrong word. All I want to say is that all supernovas are useful for, from a particle physics standpoint, is ruling this thing after that thing after the other thing out, right?
What did we rule
axions,
on? What did we rule on?
Neurons on different coupling constants.
It's very hard to learn.
So a lot of people took interest in, so why can't this do the same? If you use Dirac, we'd love to see Dirac ruled out.
But I can tell you that this is not ridiculous. You could do this, and what you do is you normalize upward the electron neutrino luminosity of the neutron star surface. And if you ask what a typical mass might be, so what's a sterile neutrino mass that's of interest here? It's sort of 1 to 10 kGb. And one of the mixing angles that we give adiabaticity here, there's something like this. They're coincident with the mixing angles and masses that one's interested in for sterile neutrino dark matter.
But that's a different problem.
I know you're asking a different question, but I think this is a more interesting one. But anyway, that's no, you're not.
It's a fine one.
It's just personal.
Not mine.
The spin flip that we've been talking about. What happens in that turbulent environment?
Complicated, because there are matter currents, right? Anisotropic matter currents.
So then there may not be.
No, that drives the conversion.
So what does that make it technically?
Adiabaticity would be broken, right?
No. No, the potentials would be larger. And so you'd have to tell me the scale of turbulence to tell me whether or not, effectively, this length scale, whether or not you could do that.
So besides the fact that you have to double the number of variables that you have in terms of the number of, of functions that you have to solve for, what does it make it so much more complicated than that to include this spin flavor? Is it because of the directionality dependence?
Yes.
Or is it because you have now two angles to worry about?
Yes. That's hard. And now the feedback on matter has to be put in. The feedback on the neutrino distributions themselves now is different than what we do with flavor transformation.
Yeah. These terms with the mass, which I assume to be a Majorana mass, and mixed Trino and Trino, are not there. They are not there. So this effect is, a big part of this effect driven by this, is only due to the Majorana nature of the first.
Completely. So I
may not be
raised the point is a very good one, and exactly. I ignored it. I've assumed that for the purpose of this talk, these are Majorana neutrinos, and that's the Majorana mass. And it's perfectly reasonable to ask what happens if there are Iraq neutrinos, and again, I just haven't looked at that in a lot of detail.
No, if you are a neutrino, you will not have this because that's a Majorana mass.
The leftover number may be completely conserved, and then you wouldn't have.
So basically what he's telling you is
this
transformation from neutrino to antineutrino that you're observing here will not happen if neutrinos are Dirac.
Yeah.
So that's why he says you can actually rule out.
Right. But then it would generate something that's effectively sterile.
Yeah.
That's what he wants to
do. No, you are actually.
Yeah. But otherwise the physics is pretty similar.
No, you would not have this effect if neutrinos are Dirac.
Yes, I'm saying you don't have this effect.
Exactly. So if you start with a neutrino, you end up with a neutrino. You will not have this effect.
There is something that I wanted to say that actually, when you said that in the first term, because there is a minus sign, this is important in the other note. No, this assumes that alpha is zero or zero. Then you would have minus two in the first and zero in the second. This is what I meant.
I can cancel in both sides.
Since alpha is entirely, it could be important in any of the two.
Okay.
That was not the. So can you distinguish ever if you get any result that is astonishingly important in this respect, and this depends only on. Can you distinguish?
I don't know. So where can we do the calculation? You're suggesting that why is this any different than the big clever calculations we've done? Well, it's structurally different. The potentials are different. The way they depend on angles is different.
But that I understand. Like so all that
turns out to be hard to do. Moreover, this is hard to explain, but you need higher energy resolution in the calculations to follow this effect. So we're even having trouble with that in one neutrino case, a single neutrino case. So what we're trying to do right now is do the baby thing. Go to a situation with no anisotropy, the early universe. Okay? Now there'll be no fancy spin coherence there because this is completely isotropic and homogeneous, so all that spin coherence goes away.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, the collisions are still.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it's very interesting. Raciel and I were just talking about this. So far, no one has actually done a full quantum kinetic treatment of neutrino decoupling in weak decoupling. So we actually don't know whether neutrinos decouple in flavor states or in mass states. We actually don't know that. The calculations that have been done put in the quantum damping, the collisional damping, the quantum Zeno effect from the measurement that comes from scattering by hand. Okay? And that's a little suspect. So when we look at our quantum kinetic equations, it's conceivable we might get something different. But mostly we just want to do this as kind of a test bed to learn how to numerically integrate these things in some reasonable fashion before we try to do them in the supernova. So it's not an exascale calculation. It's certainly not an exascale calculation in the early universe. It's pretty tractable, actually.
But then if you would put in all the complications of this convective
No convection in the real universe. Homogeneous.
No, in the supernova.
Yeah.
This becomes impossible.
Well, everything it depends on how little is your pixelation, if you want, of your problem.
Right. So what we're going to try to do is just do exactly what we did for flavor, collective flavor oscillations to begin with, which is assume spherical symmetry and don't put in all the whistles and bells that real supernova models have. And then see if we can do that and do it for two flavors. Right?
But you know that it is really not the spherical symmetry.
Right, but at least,
but you will see if this effect is really
Well, we can see whether we can get some nonlinear amplification or show where you know, some general principle where you can't get it, something like that, right?
So you're trying to plot where you had the initial Newey spectrum and then there were two spectra after that for unrealistic values of For realistic values, how does that plot change?
Well, I mean, there's much less conversion. But of course, the whole thing isn't very realistic. Because in that model, we're taking one direction, one neutrino trajectory, right? So the angle average isn't in there. The angle average can hurt you or can help you. And we're also only taking Newey and Newey bar. So there, when I add in the other flavors, then at the very least, this effect will feed back on flavor transformation. Even if it doesn't engender much velocity flip, it will still, you know, cause havoc with the flavor transformation. So.
Okay, I think we should thank George for this.